information is at kkfi.org/champion. And thank you very much for listening to KKFI.
Support for KKFI provided by AEG Presents, presenting astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson in support of his book, Letters from an Astrophysicist, at the Arvest Bank Theater at the Midland, Wednesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. The book is included on most tickets. Tickets and more information at arvestbanktheater.com.
Like most politicians, corporate executives never do anything wrong. If anything wrong does happen, it's always someone else's fault. That's been the gutless ploy of Kroger supermarket honchos who recently yanked all local news weeklies and community papers out of its stores. When a firestorm of local protests reached all the way to the mega chain's Ohio headquarters, executives quickly named the villain who banished the papers. The papers themselves. They failed to keep up with the digital age, said Kroger bosses, so shoppers no longer pick up the free papers. Bovine excrement. While it's true that chain-owned daily newspapers are losing readers after shriveling their coverage and jacking up their prices, more readers have turned to free local independent weeklies to fill the print news gap. In Lansing, Michigan, for example, media audits show that Kroger shoppers alone have nearly tripled the pickup rate of Lansing's alternative weekly since 2012. Kroger's nationwide edict is a case of corporate conceit at its most stupid. It was issued from headquarters with no warning and no consultation, much less negotiation, with the papers or communities. It didn't have to be so inept and ugly. And now, Kroger's executives have gone into hiding, petulantly refusing to meet or even return phone calls to the people they're hurting, apparently hoping the Führer will just go away. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's truly stupid. Indeed, a group of indie papers has now launched a national campaign to call out Kroger's executives, literally rallying us supporters of independent local news to give them our 2 cents worth. Call toll-free to 1-800-KROGERS, 576-4377, then press 3 to speak to a manager and demand that they restore the free press to all of their stores.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Gratitude goes out to you today for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is a locally made exploration into positive solutions to some of today's ecological challenges for all of us working to create a healthier future for our communities and for the world you live in.
Thanks for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Philip Bauer. We're glad you've tuned in to Eco Radio KC. On today's program, our guest is Carrie Gillum, investigative reporter and author of Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer and Corruption of Science, a non-documentary book which was the 2018 winner Rachel Carson Environmental Award. We're going to talk about Roundup, glyphosate, and its manufacturer, Monsanto. We're going over the evidence that Roundup causes cancer and evidence of failure of our science research to protect our health from that cancer and other illnesses. Whitewash was written in 2017, and maybe we are all aware of the safety of glyphosate. However, the latest story is that Monsanto has targeted Gillum and other critics in apparent attempts to discredit and silence their testimony. Luckily, we have an opportunity this hour to hear that testimony. You will find Carrie Gillum to be a credible witness. But first, the environmental news for the week of 10-7-19. Democracy Now! Reports nearly 70 climate activists were arrested 9/28 in New Hampshire after marching onto a coal power plant to demand an end to fossil fuel use. They were part of a group of hundreds attempting to shut down one of the largest coal-fired power plants in all of New England. Meanwhile, in Seattle, climate protesters shut down four Chase Bank branches on 9/30 to protest J.P. Morgan Chase's funding of the fossil fuel industry. 11 people were arrested. According to one count, J.P. Chase has loaned $196 billion to fossil fuel corporations since the beginning of the Paris Agreement in 2015. Two Iowa-based environmental activists have been charged by a federal grand jury with multiple felonies for their attempts to delay the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. 3 years ago, the Catholic worker activists publicly took credit for delaying construction of the pipeline for weeks, but they have always denied that their actions were violent. In the eastern Atlantic, Hurricane Lorenzo struck the Azores last week as a Category 2 storm. At its peak, Lorenzo became a monster Category 5 cyclone with sustained winds of 160 miles per hour. It was on course to strike Ireland. A recent study by British researchers found warmer ocean temperatures driven by human activity could triple the number of storms by the end of the century. EcoWatch reports, an enormous floating device designed by Dutch scientists for the nonprofit Ocean Cleanup successfully captured and removed plastic from the Great Pacific Garbage Patch last week. Ocean Cleanup has been hard at work on creating the device for 7 years. The device captures plastic in its hold like a giant arm. It was able to capture and hold debris ranging from large cartons, crates, and abandoned fishing gear to microplastic. The system's success in capturing microplastics came as a welcome surprise, since microplastics tend to fall to the ocean floor rather than float to the surface. Office of Kansas Governor Laura Kelly reports, Governor Kelly appointed Dawn Bueller Eudora to the Advisory Committee on Regulation of Oil and Gas Activities, the KCC. The committee serves to review and make recommendations on oil and gas activities, including current drilling methods, geological formation standards, plugging techniques, casting and cementing standards and materials, along with matters pertaining to the protection of waters in the state from pollution related to oil and gas activity. Dawn Bueller currently serves as a Kansas Riverkeeper and executive director for the Friends of the Kaw. Previously, she worked for the Douglas County Conservation District. She received her Bachelor of Science in Natural Resources from Oregon State University and a Bachelor of Business Accounting from Baker University. The governor's appointments to the committee are not subject to Senate confirmation. Now, our show.
All right, this is Terry Wilkie, and I'm lucky to have Carrie Gillum with us in the studio. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
Thank you for coming to our show today. Listeners, Carrie is a journalist, author, and a public interest researcher for U.S. Right to Know, and that's a internet news site. Or would you call it an internet? It's a nonprofit.
We're a nonprofit research group that, right, we primarily do freedom of information requests and put documents up for journalists, members of the public, you know, anyone interested in food research issues.
And with respect to food industry research, mm-hmm. which is just great. There is a wealth of information there. And so you authored a book, Whitewash, and that was published in 2017.
2 years ago this month.
And it has won the Rachel Carson Award for 2018, right after its publication. So this is a very wonderful book, a non-fiction, so not exactly the easiest read, and yet it does rather read like a plot or an intrigue. It has a lot of human components to it. So at the time you began to write Whitewash, Carrie, what drove you to do it? Why did you do this?
People always ask that question, and I should probably come up with a more interesting answer. The truth is, I It wasn't my idea. I was a journalist. I spent most of my career with Reuters International News Agency, and I actually was based here in Kansas City. I was assigned to cover food and farming and big companies like Monsanto and DuPont, Pioneer, and
Tyson, others. Rodeo, National Beef.
Yeah, but primarily those that were engaged in the business of selling seeds and chemicals and
plants.
Transforming, mm-hmm. you know, the way farming was done. Yeah. And, you know, a book editor came to me in 2015 and said, "You're writing really important things. I think you should put together a book." And I said, "Oh, that sounds really like a bad idea." But she changed my mind, and I left Reuters and started with a nonprofit and started writing Whitewash.
I find this to be very exciting, and I hope everyone has heard of Whitewash, and Whitewash is available. I got my copy at the public library, and it wasn't exactly easy. I had to be on the waiting list to get it, but I encourage everyone to peruse Whitewash. Now, the premise, Monsanto Corporation makes Roundup, and Roundup's chemistry made it a popular weed killer. It allowed no-till farming, but plants evolved to resist Roundup. And so then Monsanto Corporation made genetically modified crop seed and sold that. And the chemical Roundup is so used and popular that it now shows up in our food, our blood, our body water, and mother's milk. So here's the controversy. Does Roundup cause cancer and other illnesses? Carrie, what do you think?
Well, notably, you know, in the book, I don't know that we answer that question, and it's not for me to answer that question. Really, that is still something that I think, truthfully, can be said is a scientific debate around the world. We have many international cancer scientists who I quote and describe their work in the book. Many international scientists, toxicologists, epidemiologists, and others who say that there definitely is evidence that this chemical exposure to it, and not just the active ingredient, but specific to Monsanto's formulations, which use other ingredients as well.
So it's glyphosate, everyone.
Mm-hmm. Glyphosate is the active ingredient. Monsanto's mm-hmm. specific formulations included and include POEA, which is a surfactant. And the science has shown that in combination, there are synergies there that make the combination much more toxic than the active ingredient alone.
Well, it makes it more sticking, that is for sure. It reminded me rather of the PFAS, which is the Teflon
right.
chemical, which we're having to do real battle with
right.
as well.
Mm-hmm. But determining whether or not something causes cancer is really, I learned in all of my research over 20 years for this, really very difficult in people particularly, right? Because we don't put people in cages, and we're not able to control the dose and their exposure.
And hopefully we're not as simple as
right. like you are in yeah. laboratory animals. But the International Agency for Research on Cancer has determined that glyphosate and Roundup formulations are glyphosate is a probable human carcinogen with a specific tie to non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Three juries have thus far found unanimously that the weight of evidence shows that it does cause cancer. So that is the best answer I can give you at this point.
Well, that's the problem, the first problem, that it causes cancer. I would like to talk a bit about Roundup was very popular, and in 1976, I was employed as a farmer by the state of Kansas, the first woman hired in a Farmer 2 classification in the state of Kansas, and Roundup was introduced, and we were given a bucket of it. We were walking the production seed fields and asked to put a gloved hand in the bucket of Roundup and then just put a drop on milkweed plants, and that this would kill them to their root, which is a hard job to do. We had been doing this with hoes heretofore,
right.
and
mm-hmm.
We were told it was benign, and we were all intelligent. Well, I was running a crew of college students, mm-hmm. and we were really told, and I think the employers believed it was benign.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, that's what made it so popular, because this was a novel herbicide, had a novel mode of action, and was deemed to be safe for, you know, people and pets, designating and targeting an enzyme that Monsanto said was not found in humans and in animals. And, of course, the science has shown that that isn't necessarily the case. We've also found that, you know, Monsanto never actually really did much robust testing on the formulations when it comes to carcinogenicity. I mean, there have been a lot of things that have come out over the last 40 years that have shown us that Monsanto's pledges of, you know, this is benign, it doesn't persist in the soil, it, you know, has no harmful impacts for people, you know, that really isn't what science has shown us.
One of my favorite quotes from you, Carrie, when I was doing research for our interview, you said, pesticides are things that kill things. So what's the surprise? Roundup kills things. It's a pesticide. That's what it's intended to do. And we don't quite understand how plants work. And I think we're probably much smarter about animals. But when Monsanto started, they had no idea that these plants were going to evolve to resist Roundup. So that then farmers were spraying, let's say, a pint of Roundup and killing the weeds. It was like a miracle. The next year, they sprayed a pint and didn't kill all the weeds, only killed half of them. And they're like, well, let's put a quart of Roundup on.
Right.
And then the next year, it took a gallon of Roundup. Because plants, in 1 year of a human's lifetime, live many, many lifetimes. They have a much shorter life cycle, and they evolve to make the change. So,
yeah, I mean, weed resistance is a big problem, and this is something that was foreseen by weed scientists, you know, and experts, you know, in you know, biology and sort of, you know, the way that Mother Nature works, warned about this. Where you really saw this take off was after Monsanto introduced these crops, genetically engineered Roundup Ready corn and soy and cotton and sugar beet and canola, and they encouraged then farmers to spray directly over the tops of these crops. So you're spraying at a different time of the year. You can spray during the growing season. This encourages you know, weed resistance when you're spraying over and over again. Sort of the old, you know, Mother Nature adapts. True, right? And so these weed scientists warned about this and said, this is a really bad idea. You know, glyphosate Roundup might be great, but it really needs to be used in a more restrictive fashion. There needs to be proper stewardship. Monsanto said, not going to happen. Don't worry about it. We're fine. You know, they even encouraged farmers to start spraying it over the tops of wheat and oats and barley and crops that were not genetically engineered. But you could spray it right before harvest, and it would help dry down the crops. And, you know, lo and behold, we started having, you know, dozens of acres, over 100 million acres now of U.S. farmland with weed resistance, where farmers are having to go back to try to hoe, or they're using more and more of these glyphosate-based herbicides. And what you're seeing now in the Midwest is it doesn't work to such a degree that farmers are now combining glyphosate and using it with dicamba or using it with 2,4-D, these older herbicides that are also known to be dangerous to human health. And, you know, that's created a whole lot of problems in itself. So, you know, it's this pesticide cycle that companies like Monsanto's tell us, you know, just keep pouring more pesticides on the ground and that'll be the solution. You know, health and environmental scientists are saying really not a good idea.
Now, I personally marched against Monsanto. It was one of my favorite annual events. I'm sorry it has been a few years since I've seen an event. And one of the problems with spraying chemical on a grain which is nearly ready for harvest, and herbicides do make plants grow themselves to death. That's how they work. So they dry the grain out, and then you have a uniform moisture content of your grain.
Right.
And then you harvest it. It doesn't rain enough. It doesn't get washed enough. And then it goes to the food industry that makes oatmeal and flour out of it.
Right.
And your oatmeal and flour has Roundup in it, And now then, your research uncovered that this is true, that statistically we see Roundup.
Exactly. And, you know, we would have known that if the USDA and FDA included glyphosate as one of the pesticides that they tested for. These government agencies for 30-some years annually test thousands of food samples to gauge levels of pesticide residues, and they have always skipped glyphosate, even though it was the most widely used. It's only been two times now that in 2016 and 2017 that the FDA did some limited looking for glyphosate residues. But yeah, I mean, we, you know, academics and others have found in you know, the dearth of information from our government agencies, they have been testing foods, and they have found residues in, you know, as you said, in flour, in crackers, in cookies, in cereals, in beer, in wine, in drinking water. Our U.S. Geological Survey has found it in rainwater. You know, it's pervasive.
It's got that surfactant, so it tends to stick to everything that it comes in contact with. Surfactant in water will make it thin out and spread and last. And I thank you very much for your research. You have done us all a huge favor by pointing this out. And I don't have any thought or reason for the failure of government agencies to fail to do testing, not just the USDA but and the FDA, but the EPA. Your research has been critical of the work of the EPA. Of course, the modern EPA, listeners, you know, listening to our news about the EPA currently, it's a problem.
It's a mess.
It's not a protective
it's
agency.
It's just a mess.
Or it makes you wonder what it's protecting currently.
Yeah.
So I guess government agencies are like everything else. It's a good reason for us all to be involved and informed.
Right. I think I made the point in the book, but I'd like to always point out, there are people that I have come across in all of these agencies that I write about, FDA, USDA, and EPA, scientists and others who are doing good work and are trying diligently to do the job of protecting the public, to actually be public servants. And you can see that. I spend a lot of my time, and a lot of the book is dependent upon freedom of information documents that I've obtained from these agencies, internal communications and reports. And you can see these people trying to do good work. There's a great email from, you know, the 80s where an EPA scientist is writing back to Monsanto and saying, it's not our job to protect you. You know, we're trying to protect the public. But unfortunately, what you see is because of political pressures and because of campaign contributions and sway in Washington, you see these mid-level scientists often overruled.
We have about three more minutes, and then we're going to take a short break, Carrie. But in the when we come back, I want to talk about the experience you've had since the publication of Whitewash, where you've had retaliation against you by the Monsanto Corporation. And it appears that this is just the way they do business.
It's very definitely just part of their playbook. I'm just one person. I've documented in the book several scientists they've gone after. They've tried to smear and ruin the credibility of several cancer scientists around the world. So it's not that surprising that they also went after me and went after the book, you know, badge of honor perhaps. But this is how they play. It's much like the tobacco industry.
It's important to note, listeners, Monsanto has made millions.
Billions
off of Roundup.
Every year.
And then they sold their corporation to Syngenta.
Bayer. Bayer AG, giant pharmaceutical based in Germany last year.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And does Monsanto continue to exist?
Monsanto legally is listed as a subsidiary, wholly owned unit of Bayer AG, but in practicality, they have, all of their assets and liabilities have been absorbed into this giant German company.
So Bayer is essentially Monsanto.
Bayer is on the hook. The lawsuits that are pending and all of the new claims that are being filed name Monsanto as the defendant.
Well, the genetically modified crop really wreaked havoc in the seed industry. Roundup thought they had the right to put a patent on the seed that they developed. And that really had not been considered before that time. So it's done a lot of damage. We'll be right back.
County Community College, presenting Mary Bridget Davies in A Night with Janis Joplin, celebrating Janis and her musical influences in concert in Yardley Hall. Two shows on Saturday, October the 12th at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. Details at jccc.edu/Carlson Center.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. During his 5 years in the Marines, Jake Thompson served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Afterward, he expected to return to Texas and work in the oil fields like his dad. But his father suggested a different path.
He really thought I should look into the wind industry because the turbines were popping up all around my hometown.
Texas leads the nation in wind energy production. So Thompson's dad thought the industry would provide more opportunities and stability. Thompson was skeptical at first. He's afraid of heights. But he got a job as a technician and realized he could apply skills he'd learned while working on helicopters for the Marines.
All the same principles apply. You got your hydraulics, your electricity. It's just working on a turbine, you're 300 feet off the ground instead of working on a helicopter that's on the ground.
Now Thompson's been working in wind for 13 years. He's still not fond of heights, but he says it's rewarding to get a down turbine back online.
I always took a lot of pride in doing my work and doing it correctly.
Today, he works for Invenergy and was recently promoted to manager of the Stanton Wind Farm. So he's glad he took his dad's advice and tried a career in renewable energy.
I love the job.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Support for KKFI provided by AEG Presents, presenting astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson in support of his book Letters from an Astrophysicist at the Arvest Bank Theater at the Midland, Wednesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. The book is included on most tickets. Tickets and more information at arvestbanktheater.com.
Welcome back. This is Terry Wilkie, and I have a guest in the studio, Carrie Gillum, the author of Whitewash. We've been talking this hour about the Monsanto Corporation and their production of Roundup, a glyphosate active chemical that controls weeds for farmers. And Whitewash was published in 2017, and it's an award-winning documentary novel. And since that time, there has been many things happening around Roundup. The first big court judgment against Monsanto was in August of 18, and it was approximately $3
million. $289 million.
A plants man had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and the jury found that this was caused by exposure to Roundup. And by May of 19, there have been three other large jury verdicts. And the jury found not only was there credible reason to believe that Roundup caused cancer and other illnesses, but that Monsanto corrupted the science. Let's make it loud and clear for our listeners. What does that mean, corrupted the science? They misstated facts.
Well, there are a lot of examples of that. There have been a total of three court cases now and three jury verdicts. The most recent one was a $2 billion jury award to a husband and wife who both have non-Hodgkin lymphoma that they attribute to their exposure to Roundup products. The juries in all three of these cases heard evidence that of the connections to cancer, the connections to non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So they heard a lot of that science, but they also heard about Monsanto's internal strategies to deny the science and to manipulate and corrupt the science. And, you know, my book came out before there was a trial and before there was a lot, but this evidence goes back, you know, 30 years, 40 years, and it plays out in many different ways. Something that maybe is easier for readers to understand is corrupting scientific literature. So there are scientific journals that in which scientists publish peer-reviewed information that goes out to other scientists, and regulators look at this and rely on this, and lawmakers and others. It's to have research published in a peer-reviewed journal is generally considered to be, you know, very weighty and gives a lot of validity. But what we're seeing is that Monsanto, in many cases, would engineer science that declared the safety of its chemical. But they knew that it would look better if it came from independent authors, from people who looked like they didn't have anything to do with Monsanto. And so they would pay those people. Monsanto would do the studies, but they would pay people to be the authors and to sort of edit and sign their names, so to speak, is what one internal Monsanto email says. And then these would be published, and they would look like they were independent. In fact, you know, one that came out in 2016 is titled, you know, an independent review of glyphosate safety. And we know from internal documents that Monsanto was directly paying some of the authors and constructed and drafted and edited the manuscript. So, you know, and there are many examples of that.
Then, as facts happen, after you revealed in your book, Whitewash, this kind of business practice, Monsanto has retaliated against you personally.
Right.
So it's the same type of business practice now focused at Kerry Gillum. And the retaliation story is pretty new. I heard it in August of this year. And so you were able to obtain 50 pages of Monsanto internal documents that outlined a systemic plan to target you and your reputation. Now, Kerry, where did you get these documents? Was that a FOIA request?
No, these just came. They were turned over by Monsanto to the plaintiff's attorneys as discovery. They have been forced to turn over
in the lawsuits.
In these lawsuits,
injury lawsuits,
right? There are about 18,000 people suing Monsanto, and they have had to turn over millions of pages of internal documents. And you know, these about me were just one little sliver, but they are part of a much larger file about how Monsanto has sought to discredit anybody, really, any journalist, many journalists, actually, and many scientists, anyone who has raised an alarm or pointed to evidence that they have been deceitful about their product.
So outline for us, if you will, some of the instances that happened that you feel were retaliatory.
Well, I mean, they started before I ever left Reuters because it became apparent to me, you know, after just a few years at Reuters covering this beat, that what Monsanto's version of event, you know, version of the truth wasn't really anyone else's version of the truth. So, you know, as I quoted critics or as I would point to different scientific studies in my stories, Monsanto would complain to my editors, and they engaged in a harassment campaign very directly and also with industry lobbyists that they helped fund to try to get me stripped from my beat, to get me to stop covering their company and their industry. When I wrote the book, what we see in these internal documents is that they put together a spreadsheet with action items to discredit the book. This is before the book even came out. But they had a consulting company in Washington, D.C. They talked about how they want to get negative book reviews written, but that, again, they don't want them to look like they came from Monsanto. They need to look like they're coming from third parties. They want to engineer Google search engines so that if somebody types in my name, they're going to get negative information.
Well, let's talk about where a person might get a book, Amazon. And so there are reader reviews in Amazon. And my sister is a writer, and your experience is, as she has had with Amazon, where 50 reader reviews will show up, and they're almost identical, except Tom, Dick, and Harry, you know, the name of the person is different. But they come at about the same time, and they have about the same criticism of a piece of work. So that's a little transparent.
This was straight from the spreadsheet, you know, straight from the Monsanto spreadsheet.
Right, and then you had it on the spreadsheet,
and they did. They all came in, the one-star negative reviews that all kind of had the same talking points, came in over one weekend in October, shortly after the book was published, and they all had sort of identical talking points and, you know, not coincidentally, Monsanto laid out in its spreadsheet talking points for tearing down Carrie's book. So,
well, readers, I'm sure that you are like me, and when you go to buy a product or of any sort, you'll take a look at the star rating to see, okay, is this a good product? Is this the best product? Is that? And so what we learn by this is that using social media to evaluate products, it works if it works. If you have a large enough pool of people being reviewed in a kind of a more open fashion.
Now, I'm not sure it worked for them because the book still has like 4.5 stars. I mean, most of the real readers. I mean, it's frankly, other than Monsanto, the book has gotten rave reviews from professional book reviewers and awards.
They should have put that in their spreadsheet that had a factor of what happens if it's a really great book with very interesting, informative information, and then it would have skewed their report. So other things that they tried to do was pay for a web placement of a blog post about you. So listeners, I don't know how many of you Google things and go to blog posts and read about topics, but Carrie, you were one of the topics, and then Monsanto written information would pop up at the top of certain internet searches involving your name. Now, I tried to do that. I simply Googled Gillum Monsanto retaliation, and I got a website called Hogwash, and I thought that was interesting. I think that's a direct example of what you're saying.
Yeah. Hogwash and the woman who wrote that and the group that published that is you know, prime example. That group, BioFortified, is listed in internal Monsanto documents as a partner that they wanted to engage to tear down the credibility of some international cancer scientists. So it was interesting to see the only negative review, although it's not even really a book review because the woman who did it is not a book reviewer. She has stalked me, though. She's shown up at a speaking engagement and yelled and been disruptive. It's very interesting.
I read her review, in all fairness, because I'm an open-minded person, and her criticism of you was very superficial. It wasn't really substantive. It wasn't like, well, on page 3, she said this and should have said that. It was like, well, she has blonde hair. Well, who does she think she is? And so that was curious to me because I thought we were talking about Monsanto, but now we're talking about your appearance.
It wasn't very well done. You know, I mean, there was a lot of effort put into it, but it really wasn't very well done.
Well, the entire article did have its points, and I gave credit to every single point, but it was confusing because they were critical of you for saying there was a rise in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma since the introduction of Roundup, and then they showed a SEER chart, which is an incredible evidence chart, that showed an increase in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. At the same time, their text says, oh, right, there's not a rise. I guess it wasn't a big enough rise for that.
I mean, if you go to the National Cancer Institute, you see in 1975, incidence of non-Hodgkin lymphoma in 100,000 people was 10.78. And in 2015, incidence of non-Hodgkin lymphoma in the U.S. was 19.75, which seems to be pretty easy math. That's according to the National Cancer Institute.
Right. Then they talked at length about whether there was evidence that glyphosate is showing up in mother's milk. And the mother's milk argument is very interesting to me because I'm logic trained. That's an informal fallacy, the sanctity of mothers and mother's milk. It's like, how dare you even talk about mother's milk, you know? And So that was just a chance to kind of bash you. It didn't really give any substance. It didn't say, see, there is no evidence of glyphosate in any mother's milk anywhere in the world. Cow's milk, you know, sheep's milk, just a crazy thing. And then talked a lot about personalities and villains. And then it talked about whether the government is good or bad, and whether you didn't have people on your side that were saying things that you wanted them to say. So all in all, while it's critical of you, what I noted is this BioFortified seems to be interested in GMO products. And as long as I've been advocating against Monsanto, I did not quite understand until I read your book, Carrie, what's the problem with GMO products? That's how dumb I am. I'm like, you're not going to tell me a piece of wheat that's GMO'd has any less nutritional content than a piece of wheat that isn't GMO. I didn't understand the problem for people until I read Whitewash, and now I know clearly. The problem is the GMO product tells you it's been sprayed with Roundup. That's why the farmer is using a GMO product, so that they can spray it at a late date with Roundup.
Primarily. I mean, there are other types of genetically engineered crops. There's an insect, you know, resistant. There's a disease-resistant papaya. But by far and large, the largest percentage in terms of being planted worldwide and being harvested worldwide carry the herbicide-tolerant trait, and that is to allow the plant to be sprayed with herbicide. That is to encourage sales and use of herbicides. So it's not about yield. It's not about drought resistance. It's not about, you know, increased nutrition. And that's what really sort of turned me around, because when I first started meeting with these companies and they were talking about, oh, GMOs are great. You know, I started in 1998. They introduced these in the mid-90s. We're going to do all these things with GMO crops. And I kept saying, wow, that's really exciting. And I'd love to see that play out. We're going to make, you know, vegetables that taste so much better and kids will want to eat them and we can grow them with less water. And all of that really was a lovely smokescreen. But still today, you know, 20 years later, by far and large, most of the crops, most of these GMO seeds are designed to just be sprayed with a lot of herbicide.
Well, in the case of the Roundup Ready gene, that is true. And so the price we pay is at maturity, the grain is sprayed with Roundup, and then Roundup shows up in people's breakfast cereal. Now, what's the numbers on that, Carrie? The FDA did do some research on that, did they not?
Well, what the FDA has reported publicly and what they've found and discussed internally are two different things. And the documents that I have from FDA show that their own scientists have found it in oatmeal products for baby food. They found it very high levels in honey, for instance.
And granola bar.
They found
and
it
honey.
In granola.
Isn't that the truth? Yes.
And snacks. One FDA chemist says to the others, you know, the only thing I can't find it in is broccoli. But publicly, the FDA has only said that they have found it in corn and soy, and they're saying it's at very low levels and don't worry about it. Internally, they're finding it at illegally high levels in corn, but they're saying we're not going to really tell anybody about that. You know, that's a whole long chapter.
Well,
that,
I believe
you can
the
read
European
about.
Market is a analysis is a little more honest about the prevalence of glyphosate in
they've
food
been looking
stuffs.
For it.
Yes,
they've
uh-huh.
actually been uh-huh. testing yeah. for it, and Canada has been testing for it more for a longer period than just here in the U.S. Just two times with the FDA.
So it isn't that you're opposed to GMOs. And in preparing for our interview today, I talked with my friend who's a chemist, and my chemist friend was like, GMOs are okay, you know, genetically modifying organisms, including animal organisms. That's the wave of the future. That's the way our science is going. And it can be a very good thing. But the problem with this GMO is it's allowing people to spray poison on the food we eat.
Well, Monsanto in the 90s, they, you know, when they, again, you know, you can go back to internal Monsanto documentation. They talk about how this introduction of these GMO crops is going to help them hold on to and expand the market for their weed killers. They didn't talk about we're going to, you know, the farmers are going to be able to feed more people more cheaply and the world will be a better place. They talked about how they would make more money. GMOs, you know, yeah, I mean, the science, if the science is done in a way that is truly beneficial and not harmful to humans and to the environment and to, you know, farmer income and to, you know, we're protecting seed diversity and, you know, all of these different factors, yeah, sure, bring it on. But the evidence so far has really been that's not what we're seeing. It's about money, making a lot more money for a handful of companies and selling chemicals that are designed to be used with these seeds.
Carrie, are you aware of any study about the health effects of a person eating glyphosate, of a person eating glyphosate? Has that been studied?
It never is studied because, you know, I mean it isn't. Now, that's not true. I shouldn't say that. There's some Harvard researchers that put out a paper that looked at consumption of pesticides and the effects on reproductive health. There are some scientists in Indiana who have been tracking pregnant mothers and looking at the glyphosate levels in their urine and how that compares to their birth outcomes. They found the higher the levels of the weed killer in their urine, the worse the birth outcomes. So there is science, but our government is not doing any robust biomonitoring of this by any means.
I think it's all very complicated and difficult. I looked at some scientific reports on evidence of endocrine disruption, and they just looked at ovaries and testes, and they didn't look at all the other endocrine glands. They did look at adrenal, but they didn't look at the pancreas. And kidneys, I think, might be an endocrine gland, and so those things.
It's a real problem with science because, you know, we don't spend a lot of money publicly funding science. We rely in large part, our regulatory apparatus, on science that is done by the companies that are selling the products. Pharmaceutical, chemical, you know, the companies tell the regulators what the science is.
Well, Carrie, we're going to have to wrap up, and I want you to give everyone contact information for you, if you'd be so good.
Well, I have a website, carreygillam.com, CareyGillam.com, and I have I think my phone number is still on there. I don't know. I get a lot of phone calls. And my email, ways to get in touch. And you can follow me on Twitter. I post a lot of documents at Carrie Gillam on Twitter.
And I want to champion you. And so what do you have up the pipeline next?
Working on another book. I'm a consultant on a documentary on these health and environmental issues with pesticides, and just continuing to file freedom of information documents and, you know, fight for truth and transparency. Shouldn't be that controversial, but it is for some reason.
Well, don't be confused by Monsanto, Carrie. It's not controversial to you. It's all you did was lay the information out in a way that we could all understand and have our hands on. So you've done a good job. And the only people talking bad about you are people that have a self-interest.
Profit.
Right, and having you. And so it made me think, okay, Monsanto turned into Bayer. Does Bayer stand to make a profit in cancer chemical treatment? And so I Googled that. And they haven't put up their snakes to stop it. Yes, Bayer Corporation is highly invested in cancer chemical treatment.
Yeah.
So this would work for them to
make people sick, and then you get them to pay you to make them well.
Well, the good news is that we do not have to farm like this, and we can go back to no-till methods. We can rotate crops. We can be more diverse in our farming practice of crops. We can employ people or even ourselves pull weeds. The heck, I love to pull weeds. That's how I restore order into the universe. And I thank you. I thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Here's the calendar of events for 10/7/19. Wednesday, 10-9, 7 p.m., Extinction Rebellion, Kansas City Nonviolent Direct Action Training at Jacob Wells Church, 1617 West 42nd Street, KCMO. You can join Extinction Rebellion in KC for an introduction to nonviolent direct action, free and open to all. Wednesday, 10-19, is the registration deadline for a class titled Blackjack, the Trees, the Trail, and the Territory on Saturday, October 26. For more information, contact Gil Sigurdsson at 785-872-7909. Wednesday, 9-4, 6 p.m. is the Kansas City Environment Management Commission meeting of Mid-America Regional Council, Rivergate Center, second floor, 600 Broadway, KCMO. The Environmental Management Commission promotes environmental awareness for the city's leaders and staff to assist the progress of Kansas City towards ecological sustainability. The general public is encouraged to attend and observe meetings and to join and participate in its efforts. Go to kcmo.gov. Saturday, 10-12, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., enjoy a day at the Haskell Indian Nations University, 155 East Indian Avenue, Lawrence, Kansas. Come sample courses, eat at the lunch hall, or tour the beautiful wetlands. Courses will be offered free of charge throughout the day on a variety of indigenous topics. Registration is required. Registration for courses and or lunch by phone at 785-830-2770 or visit Haskell's Facebook event page. Saturday, 10-12, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., Midwest Soul Veg Fest, 18th and Vine, 1516 East 18th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Get information at MidwestVegFest.com. Sunday, 10-13, 2 p.m., Drawdown, Getting Into Action Workshop Series at All Souls, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. These items and more can be found at our Eco Radio page on www.kkfi.org and on our Eco Radio KC Face page. Please tune in next week when our guest will be from After the Harvest and our time will be Pledge Week. This is your chance to tell us Eco Radio KC is valuable to you. You can stay tuned in now for Fiesta Music Hall.
Archaeological history preserved in the Great Lakes on this current cast. The cold, fresh water of Lake Huron makes it ideal for preserving the historic shipwrecks that are part of the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary. Superintendent Jeff Gray says that although the monuments and sites might be underwater, there's plenty to see.
We really work hard to encourage people to get out in the sanctuary and experience some of these magnificently preserved shipwrecks. And you can do that through diving, kayaking, snorkeling, and we even have a glass-bottom boat now that takes people out and they can go see a shipwreck without getting wet.
There are over two dozen documented shipwrecks that can be explored, making Thunder Bay perfect for anyone wanting to experience this national treasure. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Toilets could be impacted by climate change? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Three environmental groups are asking a federal court to order the government to consider tearing down the Glen Canyon Dam on the Colorado River in Arizona.
The new lawsuit follows the release of a 20-year operating plan by the Bureau of Reclamation, which the groups say does not take climate change into consideration. They say removing the dam, which creates Lake Powell, should have been an option.
Shrinking flows on the river and less snowpack due to climate change were not considered by the Bureau, according to Dan Beard, who spoke to the Salt Lake City Tribune.
Beard is a former commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation and now serves on the board of one of the plaintiffs, Save the Colorado. He said that Glen Canyon Dam should be torn down.
However, Bureau officials have said in past interviews with the Tribune that Lake Powell plays a vital role in storing water from the Colorado River.
Gary Walkner, who heads Save the Colorado, said in a statement that the Bureau ignored ignored the best available climate science that indicates there will likely not be sufficient flows in the Colorado River to keep Glen Canyon Dam functioning.
No response to the lawsuit has yet been filed by the government.
60 million people in the U.S., about one in five households, rely on septic systems, and many of them could be affected by climate change.
Septic systems can be rendered useless by flooding or drought, and in some areas, even a decline in snow, which insulates the ground from cold, can cause systems to freeze up and stop working.
A certain level of unsaturated dirt is needed to filter out contaminants, after which the waste fills a tank where bacteria break it down.
Higher water levels infiltrate that soil, leaving no filter. And in places like Florida, it's disappearing as sea levels rise.
The Weather Channel explains that failing septic systems allow contaminants to seep into groundwater supplies or wash into bays and rivers.
A developer in Miami told CNN that when his neighborhood floods, which can happen even when it's sunny due to high tides, they walk around in sewage, which is infested with bacteria.
While more rain and sea level rise will be a problem for those systems, more droughts caused by climate change will make it difficult to get the volume of water needed to keep septic tanks functioning in other areas.
A new gel-like fluid has been developed that may help prevent wildfires before they occur.
Researchers at Stanford say the gel, which contains non-toxic materials widely used in food, drugs, and cosmetics, could be sprayed in high-risk areas, protecting them against fire for months.
Currently, wildfire managers spray suppressants and retardants on buildings in the path of a fire, but they lose their effectiveness when they evaporate, often in less than an hour. The new product stays on targets even through exposure to wind and other factors.
The researchers, working with the state of California, found that treating areas prophylactically provides complete fire protection even after half an inch of rain. Traditional retardants would provide no protection in similar conditions.
According to a release from Stanford, many wildfires originate in the same hot spots, such as roadsides, campgrounds, and along remote electrical lines. Treating those areas could provide a highly targeted approach to wildfire prevention.
There's an increased awareness about the environmental impacts of textile production, and one area of concern is waterproof clothes that are made with toxic chemicals.
But making clothes with safer chemicals that also allows them to breathe has been a challenge.
Now, scientists have developed an ecological and water-repellent coating, which also retains breathability and the natural feel of clothing.
Researchers at Aalto University in Finland developed the coating from carnauba wax, which is used in medicines, food, and even car polish.
The wax comes from Brazilian palm trees, which protects its fronds from moisture loss by secreting a substance on leaf surfaces.
In a release from the university, the researchers explained that after processing, the new coating can be applied by dipping, spraying, or brushing on clothing surfaces.
However, because it's not resistant to detergents, it's best suited for less frequently washed outer garments like jackets.
While more research is still required, consumers may be able one day to apply the coating themselves to the textile after each wash.
And finally this week, if you find yourself along the East River in Upper Manhattan, look for colorful lights in the shape of a giant plus sign bobbing in the water.
A new floating sculpture there, called Plus Pool Light, is part science and part art. Lights change colors based on water conditions. If it glows blue, it's safe to swim. While if it's pink, that means bacteria levels exceed safety standards.
The sculpture, created by Playlab Inc. and Family New York, also changes direction based on water currents, turning clockwise when they're flowing north and counterclockwise when they flow south.
The brightness, frequency, and sharpness of the lights reflect the measurements of oxygen, turbidity, and pH, respectively.
The 50 by 50 foot lights are arranged into a plus sign to signify the positive steps New York City has taken since the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972.
Shawnee Traylor, a science advisor for the project, told The Gothamist she thinks there are other possibilities of using data visualization. The Empire State Building could display air quality, or Central Park could show how much carbon it's sequestering.
Even if you're not in New York, you can see current water quality in the East River at an online dashboard where, at the time of this newscast, the water was low in pathogens but high in oxygen.
The installation is temporary and ends January 3rd.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, whose North American Water Loss Conference will showcase innovative solutions December 3rd through 5th in Nashville. Get the details at awwa.org/waterloss.
Eco Radio is produced by a team of collaborators, including yours truly, Craig Lubo, Teresa Wilkie, Dave Bennett, and Brent Ragsdale. Thanks to Ryan Porky for our theme music. I'm Richard Nabian, reminding you to give your feedback by contacting us at ecoradio@gmail.com or reaching out to Eco Radio KC, our Facebook page.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
During the beginning of the 20th century, yet another unique American music form developed. When Mexican-American musicians from Texas began to play the accordions brought by immigrants from Germany and Czechoslovakia, the result was Tejano, or Tex-Mex music.